When you hear the song We Are the World, what does that remind you of? And does anybody really know the song outside of the chorus? Well, send them your heart, right?
Is that the... No.
So yeah.
Okay, you just
answered
your own question, right? I don't
and
know
their
it.
Lives right. Will be stronger and free.
Nice.
Wow.
Okay.
Make sure she don't have the lyrics in front of her.
Me, I know.
I know.
Okay, on phone, talking about, yeah, girl, I know the lyrics. Okay. Oh, you and Mr. Gosh. Google know the lyrics.
Well.
Let me tell you the best part. Well.
Oh, Cindy Lauper. That part
that's my
was,
girl, though.
That Cindy was Lauper. A good, that was a good Cindy. Good job.
Thank you.
Well, we watched that documentary about the making of the magical night where we saw the biggest superstars in music gather to record We Are the World. From WBEZ Chicago, this is When Magic Happens. I'm Taylor Coward, here with Cheryl Jackson and Jennifer Shea Love Bowers. And I told y'all we would do a documentary club. I manifested it, y'all. It's here. And today I am so excited for our very first documentary club episode. Me, Jennifer, and Cheryl watched The Greatest Night in Pop on Netflix, and we're going to talk all about it today. So stick around, more after the break.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
So, initial thoughts. I just want to begin by saying I learned a lot about the 80s. I learned a lot about the AMAs. And a shocking thing I learned is that there was once a category called Favorite Black Single.
I know. I was shocked. Like, whoa. They just came right out and said it. Okay. Talk about segregation.
And I'm like, is that what became like the urban category?
Yes. I was shocked. So you learned a lot. I was living through
you were
the 80s.
Reminded.
Okay. I was reminded. and when I heard that AMA, the black single category, I was like, what in the Jim Crow South is this? Okay.
She said it so like chipper. She's like, let's see who had the best and favorite black single. I was like, black? What?
My Lord Jesus.
Yeah, I had no idea that that was a single. Okay. So my introduction to We Are the World was after MJ died. I was just like watching all his videos. I had seen it before, but like a deep dive and a full viewing was after he passed. And then after that, remember they made another one for Haiti.
Yes.
And I think Wyclef was kind of at the helm of it.
It was the Quincy Jones.
That's inflammatory.
It was the Quincy Jones.
But it was really... I don't know. It just really was influential. So what I learned is that the king of all kings, Harry Belafonte, was like who kind of brought this. Because I now know that like famine in Africa is a problem. But I didn't know that that was not in the public consciousness in the 80s.
Right. Like you, I lived through the, well, unlike you, I lived through the 80s. Mm-hmm. I was a sophomore in college. Mm-hmm. At Northwestern when this song hit. And but I did not know Harry Belafonte was behind that.
Me neither.
It wasn't in my consciousness that he was such the advocate, the civil rights activist that I now know. But yeah, it just, you know, it was like all your favorites were in this one song. And you were like, wow. And the contrast of the different voices, but it was all of your favorite artists were in this one song.
And what I really liked about this documentary is it's like you get to see it from the very beginning, like the idea Harry had and then calling the manager, Lionel Richie's manager at the time, and just being like, no, Harry, like something like this was already done. Let's use our connections to like take it to the next level. And seeing what the process is like of
getting all of those megastars together.
The behind the scenes.
Yes.
Was and fascinating.
It was so smart for them to be like, let's use the AMAs. We don't have to fly these people here. We don't have to pay for their hotels. They'll all be here. But then that gave them the pressure to strike.
Right.
Like in a night.
The timeline was intense to write the song, which was so funny to me.
Stevie Wonder not answering the phone.
Didn't pick up the phone. And they were blowing up his phone. So then Michael and Lionel.
Lionel Richie.
That's what Michael Jackson called Lionel. Lionel were in Michael Jackson's home. And what was so hilarious is all these animals were just popping up.
The snake. Yes.
He's like, oh, there's he is. Lionel's like, that's my cue to go.
I know. Okay. Jennifer, I'm curious, where were you when We Are the World came out?
The thing I remember about that time was I would always, to my parents, want to do things, mm-hmm. you know, like do things to, like if I heard about, you know, child kidnapping or just any kind of travesty, I would want to do something. And so I do remember when that song came out, it was a sort of heightened awareness about famine, you know, which really there were no visual images that really told that story that I knew about, you know. And so this kind of like highlighted the real issue around what was happening in Ethiopia. And then I thought it was fascinating how Michael Jackson made music.
Yes.
Like how he was, so Lionel Richie was describing how he had to communicate with him, mm-hmm. you know, it was almost like in beats, you know, it was how he sort of processed actually creating a song. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was just so, so fascinating that like this brilliant man in a couple of days created a song, you know, that everybody had a part in. And I thought it was extraordinary.
Well, here's what I also learned, mm-hmm. that Michael Jackson didn't read music.
And Michael Jackson wasn't even planning on being in this song. It was so interesting to see like how he delivers music. Like he just records himself.
That's what I'm
humming
saying. He doesn't read music. He doesn't write it down. He doesn't notate it. This musical genius does not know how to notate the music.
Yeah.
That was like, what? You did all of this, all of these
in
huge...
a couple days, like Jennifer said, like because they were kind of playing around at first, if you remember.
He was humming it.
Yeah,
they were humming it, and they weren't really sticking strict to the deadline of the AMAs. Mm-hmm. And Quincy Jones had to call and be like, "I need a product. Like we have stars, and we have nothing for them to sing." And Michael Jackson just starts like humming and beatboxing into a mic, and like. For We Are the World to come out of that is so amazing. And it was amazing to see that, like, he didn't even plan on being on the song. Like, he's like, I'll write it. But he's like, this is too much exposure for me to be in this, so I'm not even going to be on it. And Quincy Jones is like, you got to be on it. And, like, imagine a We Are the World without Michael Jackson.
I must have missed that part. Now, why was he going to be in it?
He said it was too much exposure.
For him to be exposed?
No, like, he was just like, this is not about me. Like, and I think you kind of see that in the documentary of like people mm-hmm. kind of losing sight of what they're actually supposed to be there to mm-hmm. do.
And you mean egos.
Yeah. And egos, and so Quincy
which
Jones
they had to put a sign up for that,
which I love. He wrote on a piece of paper. Same. Quincy Jones wrote on a piece of paper. Check your ego at the door. And mm-hmm. Bob Geldof, who did Band Aid, mm-hmm. he had to get on the mic and he was like, hey, you can go to the country that we're trying to help right now and see dead children, one bag of flour for a whole family to eat food, malaria, typhoid, no water, things that you cannot comprehend. And that's what we're here for, to make a difference with that. Because people were like kind of getting into, well, I didn't get a solo.
Right.
Well, I'm tired. I just left the AMAs. I want Roscoe's Chicken and Waffles. And like just kind of having ego, having celebrity and not really acknowledging that we're here for famine and to raise money and awareness. And I think that set like a sobering mood across the room and kind of refocus people.
Got people to reset.
And you need that sometimes. Like,
but I was curious how people got their solos. Like, what was the reason? Like, how they get a solo. And it was interesting to learn it. They were trying to do all this contrasting.
Oh, the arranger. And,
yes.
Oh, my gosh.
It was really cool.
That seemed like the coolest job ever. The guy who was just like, Steve Perry would sound good here.
Yes.
The Boss would sound good here.
Right.
This is where Diana Ross
like
could
the
go.
Boss and his, they said Dirty Voice would sound good
I
here.
Love
and they said Tina's voice was beautiful at the bottom.
And warmth.
And warmth at the bottom.
Yeah. Mm.
Okay. And I was just like, wow.
You know we love Tina.
So cool. Yeah. Tina does know.
You
wrong.
Know we love.
Okay.
But I love Bruce Springsteen.
Me too. And, I thought the same thing.
And Born in the USA is one of my favorite albums. I'm on Fire is my jam. And for him to have just done that whole tour and then fly to L.A. to go, like he had just rapped in Buffalo and then went to go do that song. He really didn't complain as much as other people were complaining.
He didn't. He was the most grounded and down to earth.
And doing the song.
And it's very consistent with who he is. But I've always been a Bruce Springsteen fan.
Me
like
too.
Sting as well.
Have we not talked about this?
I don't know. Yeah, we need to talk about
that. Hey, when he comes back to Chicago.
We need a Black Girls Club for Bruce Springsteen.
The Boss.
Yeah, the Boss.
The Black Bosses.
Yeah. We're his real bosses.
Copyright. Copyright, copyright. Can we talk about Stevie Wonder? Can we get into it?
Baby.
Jennifer, okay.
Yeah, I'm here for it.
Jennifer, you have experience with celebrities. What was that like for you? Like seeing... Because a lot of this was just ego management and celebrity management. I think the documentary showed us what it's like to have all these people in a room that have demands, assistants, glam squads, and all of that is taken away and stripped down. And I just feel like being in that world, what was it like seeing them have that all stripped away?
Yeah, well, I thought it was... it seemed like for some, it was humbling, you know, to think that like, oh, wow, in their mind, like this person's bigger than me or this person, you know what I mean? Like, like seeing them actually seeing their demeanor kind of change, you know,
or just imposter syndrome. They're like some of these people in the room, like, you know,
they said Ray Charles is like watching the Statue of Liberty walk in.
Right. I would have had imposter syndrome. You know, some of these people like, OK, How'd you get in this room?
Oh, well, I think that was felt like, and I think my question for Jennifer is more out of like, because they specifically said, we are only going to have the artists in the room. Your glam squad can't come in. Your assistant can't come in.
Your hype crew can't come in.
Your hype crew
can't come in.
And so much of celebrity personality, I think, is built on the people around them. And when you don't have that anymore...
Totally.
It's like, who are you as a person? And I was just wondering, like, as someone in radio who meets people like this, what was it like seeing them, like, in a vulnerable state?
You know, I thought it was interesting, like, for example, with Cyndi Lauper, I think it was, where they were like, oh, this song isn't even going to be big. Like, don't do it, you know?
She's like, my boyfriend said.
Yeah, but what was so interesting is I'm like, how... as opposed to being connected to the purpose, you know, how it really was for some about a hit, you know, how can I be kind of aligned? And I'm thinking to myself, well, all y'all in the room, it's going to be a hit, you know, because that in and of itself is unusual. But yeah, I did think it was interesting that they're one with so many different personalities and what happens when all those personalities are kind of in a room and I think even, you know, you said it, but like when they put the sign on the door, it was almost like you had to do that in order to truly let people be vulnerable and just do the thing, just sing, you know?
And which is why they needed Bob to get up there and remind them why they're even here. Because people got concerned with, is it a hit? Will I have a solo? Will I this? Will I that? And not remembering that it was a charity song for a purpose. And I think you need those moments, that like redirection. I also was chuckled to see like how hard it is to control that many large creative personalities.
Right.
They called it like a creative ball of energy. Imagine 18 Cheryls, 10 Taylors.
Maybe it's only one Cheryl.
About 20 Jennifers. Okay. And you're just like, y'all, please. Like Quincy Jones kept having to be like, please.
I don't know how they did. It's really a miracle the way they were able to pull all of those folks together. I You know, when I worked for NPR mm-hmm. at headquarters back in the day, we took Morning Edition on did a road show, and we went, L.A., just all over East Coast, mm-hmm. West Coast, and all the personalities who were associated with the show at the time, and it was no small feat. Yeah. There were about maybe five or so personalities that traveled with the show. Mm-hmm. And it's just no small feat. Yeah. I don't even know. How did anyone could even think that would have worked, okay,
yeah.
Number one. But number two, I think it was brilliant to have set it up for one day only mm-hmm. and one take, essentially.
And that's
night,
it.
And that's
yeah.
it. Because it wouldn't have been able to sustain itself beyond a day.
I think that's what makes it so special. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, Diana Ross was crying when it ended, and she was like, I didn't want this to be over. Mm. Because it's those, like, lightning striking once moments,
yeah.
which is why I personally love theater. Like, my theater teacher, Mr. Winkler, would always tell us that theater is ephemeral. And he's like, we make this thing, we do it all together, we make these bonds, and then it's over. It's gone. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's what they were feeling with We Are the World, because it's like, there's no other time that all of us will be in this setting at the same time doing this thing together. And it was like just very special.
Did you expect Stevie Wonder to be a Debo?
So that's what I want to get into. I hollered when they were like, okay, of course we want Stevie Wonder to write a song.
Right.
But he took about 3 weeks to get back to us. And then we start laying down a demo.
After they wrote the song.
We write the song.
Uh-huh.
We come up with music. And he walks into the room and says, all right,
let's get started on writing a song.
Let's write a song.
And they were like, and they looked at Quincy like, you need to handle this.
Handle him.
Yeah, handle him.
Right.
Tell him.
But it was, I felt a lot of that, of like, hey, do I really redirect Stevie Wonder right now? Or like, people weren't really liking some of the lyrics, and so Smokey Robinson was like, Mike, this don't make sense. And he was like, everybody was looking at me crazy because they're like, how dare you tell Michael Jackson that his lyrics aren't good? And he's like, but we did Motown together, I've known him since he was 10, I can talk to him like that. But when right. you have all these big people in a room, I could see where it could be intimidating to redirect someone you really look up to. And mm-hmm. like Cyndi Lauper says she was like really anxious. Huey Lewis was like, I was really anxious. Bob Dylan, they had to clear everybody out the room so he could sing his solo. Like, he just could not get it out with everybody in the room.
That's not surprising.
Okay, Bob. Okay. I don't understand.
I don't get that either.
But y'all are from an era where he was, so can you explain?
Yes, I lived through that era, and I struggled with trying to understand then, and I still don't understand. So I just, I just have to leave that up to the culture that built and created that. I don't understand it.
I think he's one of those people that, like, he is more than just the voice. Like, he also, kind of like Harry Belafonte, he was like the concerned artist.
Right.
Not equating the two, but in the sense of like, he has initiatives that he stands for. He's vocal about change and awareness. And when you think of Bob Dylan, you think of a unique voice. But I'm sure if you're standing next to like Bruce Springsteen, Diana Ross, Ray Charles, it's going to be stressful to like have your voice be the center of what's happening.
Yeah, I think, he was a strange dude. And I think people just appreciated that he was vibrating on a different level.
Period.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they were like, just Bob Dylan.
It was just Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that became a part of his brand.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
On Curious City, every listener's question leads to a surprising story. Whether it's the history behind Chicago's folk scene, fashion industry, or the worst year in sports we've ever had. Uncover more of Chicago's hidden stories wherever you get your podcasts.
Wait, I just remembered when Stevie Wonder, this was the ultimate frustration moment where I was cackling. Mm-hmm. Stevie Wonder was like, we need some Swahili in this song. So everybody starts mumbling and murmuring. And someone's like, they don't even speak Swahili in Ethiopia. And he's like, well, we can translate it to what it needs to be. And then finally, you just see a man get up and leave. And Waylon Jennings was like, a good old boy isn't going to be singing no Swahili. And leaves. Waylon Jennings left early. He was like, I'm not singing no Swahili, and left. And so he was supposed to be on We Are the World, but he left.
Wow.
I was screaming. And so they were like really frustrated about Stevie Wonder trying to add the Swahili. I think a part of that was that he maybe regretted he wasn't in the songwriting.
I think he's frustrated. He's trying to put his personal stamp on that.
But they were like, it's done. Like, we have, it's
that
10
was
at
hilarious.
Night.
It's a song.
It's a song.
It's Stevie. It's done.
Steven.
Elvis has left the building. It's done.
I love vintage footage. And I feel like seeing like 80s LA was so exciting to me.
I know, right?
How about that phone, though? How about that phone?
Okay, we just did an episode. Didn't we do an episode on phone? That's what I'm talking about. That big phone, okay?
Ginormous.
With the big, long antenna coming out of it. It was hilarious.
I think we need to talk about the tech.
And did you hear the reference to the car phone?
Yes.
They had a phone because it was in the middle.
Yes.
Okay, you hear that reference?
I am amazed that they pulled that off. Like, they were sending out cassette tapes of the song in the mail.
And did you see FedEx was Federal Express?
Federal Express.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
The way that they pulled that off in a short amount of time with, like, no, you couldn't email somebody's assistant. Mm-mm. They were picking up the phone and calling people and being like, and I also liked how they sold it based on the kind of foundational artists that they had. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of people were like, oh, you got Bruce Springsteen? I'm on that thing.
That's right.
Yeah. And they were just, they had to call in and use the people that they had to, like, sell it, basically, on the phone. And I was just so amazed by that.
It was amazing. But that all of that got started. It started with Harry Belafonte.
Which I love.
And I just love that. I wished I were more aware of his activism and presence and contributions while he was still alive.
Yeah.
You know? But I'm glad to know it now.
And I think he got his flowers when he was here. Like, when they all started singing his song, he looked like so, like, bashful. And he was like, please stop. But, like, everybody knew it. Everybody, like, sang it. And you know it's a room full of talented people because it was, like, perfect harmony. It sounded so good. Mm-hmm. And, like, I think that's how you know the caliber of talent that they had in the room, because even when they first kind of got the first chords of We Are the World going, it sounded like a practice rehearsed song, but they really had just learned it, just were listening to it. It is so much to rehearse something, do it, and then make the official recording all in one night. Like, they recorded the video there. So it made me go back and watch and be like, how big does Diana Ross's hair get by the end of this taping? Because it was so hot in there. Her hair just kept getting, like, bigger and bigger and bigger. So a former guest of When Magic Happens, Sheila E., I feel like her storyline in the documentary was so interesting and how that tied into the absence of Prince. So
yes, he should have been in that.
What are our thoughts on that?
Prince should have been in that. But, you know, I understand. I mean, I'm not surprised that he's not in it. I mean, talk about, it's another person that's vibrating on another level.
I just wonder where in that song they would have put him.
I would have been there for it. It would have been a little, ooh, something. Okay, it would have been, what?
He wanted a guitar solo. And they were like, we don't need guitar in this particular joint. And they were like, sorry. And he was like, no, if I'm doing it, there's a guitar solo. And they were like, but we don't need a guitar solo. And
I'm not surprised they couldn't rile him in.
But Sheila E. felt that that was the only reason they had her there.
You're trying to get to Prince.
Yeah.
It's probably true, because I was kind of curious. Like,
well, they were promising her a part. And she was like, I was surprised, but I was humbled. And then she was like, but as the night went on and they kept asking me, where is Prince? She was like, I realized that I think they just had me there so that Prince would come.
Right.
And she's like, that hurt.
Yeah.
I know they were trying to get Madonna, but
it was between Madonna and Cindy, apparently.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm glad they went with Cindy.
No Such shade an interesting
to,
voice.
Yeah, no shade to Madonna, but yeah. I'm glad they went with Cindy. Like, I don't know what Madonna would have brought to that. That would have been
her audience. Unique. I think they were considering she would bring in young people mm-hmm. to the song. Mm-hmm. But Cindy's voice is so distinctive.
Yeah, so distinctive.
Yeah, it is.
So distinctive. Who else would I have wanted in that song?
Jennifer. Who'd you want on the track?
You're the music girl.
Yeah, I would think one of the, like, El DeBarge or someone from that, you know, crew. Because they have a distinct sounding voice.
I agree.
Maybe like Patti LaBelle.
Yeah, you know, that's what they were missing. They were missing that black female voice that could
extra,
belt.
Like soul.
That could belt it, you know. They were missing Patti LaBelle. They were missing, I was thinking a gospel artist, but I think you hit the nail on the head. They were missing that black woman soul, you know, not pop, but R&B soulful that could belt a song. Hmm. I'm here for Kenny Loggins.
So, he's so soulful.
Oh, yes.
I mean, these are soulful voice and very big in my 80s, my college years. So,
I think mine is Whitney Houston.
Yes.
I think I would have wanted Whitney Houston on there, or I could also see Barbara Streisand.
Was Whitney Houston a thing at 85, though?
Wait, when was her rendition of, I thought that was around the Star Spangled Banner.
That was later. Yeah, but her first album, I think her single, was either 86. Is somebody Googling that?
You Give Good Love came out, her debut album came out in 85.
Okay, yeah.
Saving All My Love For You came out in 85.
But this was at the top of 85. When they recorded We Are the World, it was January 85.
So she hadn't hit it
yet.
Dion could have brought her.
Dion was trying to get a spot for herself.
Dion wasn't coming.
She was in Las
Vegas. I'm in Vegas.
How did they get her there?
Quincy Jones. And she was like, if Quincy Jones calls you, do what he asks you to do. But I think Whitney Houston and Barbara Streisand.
Now, Barbara Streisand, that was her era. And she should have been in. I mean, he has a beautiful, strong voice. She should have been in there. Whitney, this was just a little pre-Whitney.
Got it.
Stardom. Okay. But Barbara Streisand, she had done, Yentl.
Love that movie.
Yes. She should have been in this song.
Probably scheduling because she was in the remake in like 2009 or 10.
Barbara Streisand has one of those greatest voices of
I
all
love
times.
Barbara Streisand.
I do too.
Don't make me start singing Evergreen on the pod.
Jesus. I love the Barbara Streisand movies. The soundtracks, the individual songs. I just love Barbara Streisand. Barbara Streisand, Celine, Whitney Houston.
Celine Dion wasn't in this song.
But she was early, this too soon.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, she was not around. Trust me, I was there.
It was a lot of men in the song, now that I think about
it. Yeah, a lot of men.
Yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm.
But I don't know where a Prince guitar solo would have fit, honestly. As much as I love him and his guitar, I don't know where that would have fit.
It was never going to work. Let me tell you that.
And that's a wrap for our first Documentary Club episode. If you like what you heard, subscribe, rate us on Apple Podcasts, and tune in every Friday for your dose of When Magic Happens. And follow us on Instagram at When Magic Happens Podcast. You can find me, Taylor Coward, on Instagram at Taylor Coward Online.
You can find me, Jennifer Shaylove Bowers, on Instagram at Being Shaylove.
You can find me, Cheryl Jackson, on social media at Cheryl Jackson. That's Cheryl with an E.
When Magic Happens is a production of WBEZ Chicago and a part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our truly magical producer is Brianna Garrett. Brendan Banizak is our executive producer. Tracy Brown is chief content officer, and engineering by Maria Lopez. See y'all next week.
I'm Rick James, bitch.